So once again, welcome. I want to go back to the model that I started talking about yesterday and move along with it. And that's the model known as the four Brahmaviharas, or four divine abidings or supreme states, or in the translation that I used, the four qualities that make up our best home. And like any home, we may not be there all the time, certainly. We leave, but we return. And when we return, there should be a certain feeling. It should be the place where we feel the most authentic, the least pretentious. We're home. So these four qualities are loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Now, there's a whole model in the Buddhist psychology where each of these is spoken about in terms of what's called the far enemy, the near enemy, and the proximate cause, or the nearest arising condition, the likeliest springboard for the Brahmavihara quality to arise. It's not the sole root or cause by any means, but it makes it much more likely for the condition, the quality we're cultivating to come about. And equanimity itself, as the fourth of the Brahmaviharas, is also said to play a role in the first three. The wisdom component of equanimity helps guard our hearts from the far enemy, and the balanced nature of equanimity helps keep the first three from falling into their near enemy, which I'll describe in just a minute. So equanimity helps the other three be more themselves and less swayed or overcome by the near enemy, and also helps the state be much more boundless, not just directed toward those whom we like distinctly and personally in our lives, but a much more open sense of being able to offer compassion or sympathetic joy beyond that narrow little circle of beings that we call us in some way. So loving kindness, as the first Brahmavihara, is a sense of connection. It's the art of friendship. It's an acknowledgement of connection, that the life we see in front of us includes rather than excludes any being. The far enemy of loving kindness is aversion, which is anger or fear. And in the Buddhist psychology, these are the same mind state, anger and fear. They're just two different manifestations. Anger being the energized, outflowing form, fear being the held in, frozen, imploding form of striking out against what's happening, wanting to declare it to be untrue. But they're really the same state in two different manifestations. So that's the clear opposite of loving kindness. If loving kindness has us connect, aversion has us shun or reject or disregard. And again, loving kindness doesn't necessarily mean we like somebody or everybody. And it certainly doesn't mean that we approve of their actions. But there's some inclusive sense that our lives have something to do with one another. That's the nature of loving kindness. So it's easy to see the opposite as fear or aversion, where we're pushing away rather than being with in the nature of loving kindness. The near enemy of loving kindness. Now, the near enemy is a state that's close enough, so we could confuse it with the Brahmavihara state. But it's really essentially very, very different if we understand it. Because it's so close, it can masquerade as that state. But if we really look, we'll see, not really. And again, it's equanimity, it's the balance of equanimity that helps the Brahma-vihara state from falling into its near enemy. So it's what helps loving-kindness from falling into attachment, which is its near enemy. It's what I described yesterday as metta, or loving-kindness with an edge. May you be happy by, well, let's see, we don't have that much time, actually, because by Sunday afternoon now. In the following 15 ways, and do it just like this, or thank me for my magnificent gift of loving-kindness to you. Some level of expectation, conditionality, inevitably frustration, a confrontation with the fact that no matter how hard we try, we are not in control of the unfolding of events, of someone's choices, of someone's life. And again, you know, there's a certain level of human reality where, of course, we want to be thanked. It's just natural. But how much do we need to be thanked? How much does that attachment overcome the sense of pure giving in loving kindness? So sometimes I tell the story about how I went to India some years ago with a group of people, and it was like 91 or something like that. And we visited various teachers and gurus in the trip, some Buddhists, some non-Buddhists. And there were some younger people along on the trip as part of the group. And then when we got back to the States, after some time, one of these young men came to me and he said, I'm thinking of bringing my father to India, to this particular city, to meet this particular guru. What do you think? And I thought about it and I said, you know, I think that's a really bad idea. India has so many beautiful places, and that particular city is not one of them. Likely to be really hot, the food will be different and maybe not so good for him, and it'll be buggy and he might not, you know, he might get sick. And then, you know, really, frankly, the scene around that guru is kind of strange, and, you know, it's possible that you're going to turn him off spiritual pursuit forever, and, you know, it seems so strange. I think it's a really bad idea, but he didn't listen to me, and he went anyway with his father. And then I saw him some time after he got back. So I said, how was it? And he said, it's the best thing I've ever done in my life. He said, my father loved India. He loved the place. He loved the food. Didn't get sick. And he said, love the guru. Not only did he love the guru, he decided to become a disciple of the guru. And not only did he decide to become a disciple of the guru, he decided he wanted to teach in the guru's lineage. So he was going to devote the entire rest of his life to serving the guru and getting close to him. And I thought, wow, was I wrong? It's like, you couldn't be more wrong in a piece of advice. So there's a moment. Can I be happy for them that they did well? Or am I going to silently fume? We shouldn't have really gone, you know, or whatever it is. You know, I'm not happy you had a good time. Attachments are so insidious. You know, the kind of grasping or holding, insisting on being right, wanting to be in control. And it really does interfere with that free offering of a sense of friendship. Like, wow, I'm really glad things worked out so well. What I really wanted was for you to be happy and for this to work out. And it happened, even though I was totally wrong. So what? So the near enemy can often masquerade as loving kindness, but it's very different. And you can see how a sense of balance, equanimity, a bigger perspective about things. That sense of spaciousness is what helps loving kindness from falling into attachment, and also helps, once we have fallen into attachment, to recover, to come back to that really much more powerful and important state, which is the loving kindness itself. Not just perpetuating the cycle of attachment and frustration in that way. So equanimity works with that. And then the next Brahmavihara is the state of compassion. So compassion is sometimes defined as the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. We see pain, we recognize suffering, and our hearts move. It's a movement toward, in a way. Some teachings say it's a movement toward to see if we can be of help, to try to alleviate the suffering. But in fact, we can't always alleviate the suffering. And then we see compassion really as kind of being like a companion, a presence, in a state of generosity with the suffering, acknowledging what's happening rather than denying it, and yet not feeling we need to control that which we can't control, we need to fix everything, that we are responsible right now for making it all better, which is all delusion. So the far enemy of compassion, the clear opposite, is cruelty. It is sometimes defined as having such a distinct sense of otherness that what happens to the other doesn't matter. So that, you know, a person is not seen as a person, but as an object, they're dehumanized. You feel almost like, oh, anything can happen to them. It doesn't matter. It doesn't count. That's cruelty. It's a lack of empathy, a lack of resonance with the pain some situation is causing another or could cause another. The near enemy of compassion is this very interesting state. It's hard to describe sometimes. Someone suggested the word despair to me. The common translation is sorrow or grief, but it doesn't mean sorrow or grief in the Western psychological sense. It really means a sense of being broken by the suffering that we see. So we are just exhausted and feel shattered, so that there's nothing in us that is left for the sense of going forward. So I want to go back for a moment to talk about generosity as an example, because compassion too, as we talked about briefly yesterday, is like a practice of generosity. So generosity can come from many motives. I'll talk more about motivation this afternoon. But we know that, you know, just from life. We can give out of a sense of delight and happiness. We can give out of a sense of obligation. We can give because we don't feel we deserve to have anything, and therefore we're just going to give it away. There's so many different places within us generosity can come from. And some of the best kinds of generosity is said to come from a sense of inner abundance. It's essential, in a way, for there to be some sense of inner abundance for us to be able to give or relinquish or share. And I think this was made very evident to me going to a country like Burma, where in a monastery, for example, if you go to practice, very often you don't pay a fee, not even for room and board. Because everything that you need is donated by the people. Every meal you have is a donation. And as I said yesterday, if it's your birthday, you don't necessarily expect to get gifts, you expect to give gifts. So it's your birthday. You go off to the monastery, you feed everybody. That's how you celebrate. And so everything, every meal is an offering. And of course, Burma is, you know, a very poor country, and yet every single meal was offered to us. And it was always the best of what people could provide, whatever that might mean. And very often people would come and watch you eat the meal because it brought them so much joy. And you could just see how happy they were, even if they had relatively so little materially. You could see how delighted they were at the opportunity to give. And it used to be so striking to sometimes spend months there and then go back to the States and see how people with maybe a vast amount more materially or objectively didn't even have the inner feeling that they had enough. And so they didn't feel they could share anything. And you realize that the generosity reflected some inner state, even more than the outer measurement of how much somebody had. So that is very relevant to the sense of compassion. If we feel completely depleted, exhausted, overcome, without any kind of sense of inner abundance, we can't go there in a state of suffering. We just have to withdraw, or things get very distorted. Our motivation gets, you know, stranger and stranger in our work, in our activity. And we see it, you know, it's not just material generosity. That's just the template we use as an example, because it's easy to use it in that way. It's much more concrete. We see it a lot in, say, loving kindness practice, where traditionally one begins with oneself and offering loving kindness, and then we move to benefactor, someone who's helped us, someone who's inspired us. And there have been so many times when I've offered that instruction and people have come to me and said, well, you know, I chose the Dalai Lama as my benefactor, or some great saint, or somebody like that. Let's say the Dalai Lama. I chose the Dalai Lama as my benefactor, and I started offering them loving kindness. And then I began thinking, what do they need me for? I mean, it's the Dalai Lama. And I always find that so interesting. Both, first of all, how do we know? You know, for all we know, a person like that is nourished every day by the well-wishing and loving kindness and prayers of others. And also, what an interesting conclusion, that what I have to give is so negligible. It's so nothing. It's so meager. Couldn't possibly make any difference. It's that same sense inside of a kind of bleakness. So for compassion or loving kindness to be more all-inclusive, more boundless, and not to fall into the near enemy, we need that sense of equanimity. And in compassion, the near enemy is that sense of just being shattered. And when we look at that, we see many things. That feeling of being responsible, needing to make it all better. It's all up to me. It's got to happen now. I have failed. I can't bear the feeling of helplessness or powerlessness. All of which is very depleting. And here, actually, the Dalai Lama is my model, one of my models, in this sense. And I probably talked about this last year when I was here, but when he came to the States some years ago and did that public talk in Central Park, the first time he did it, there were about 250,000 people there. And when he first began, he began with a statement I found quite remarkable when he said, from a certain point of view, I haven't had such an easy life. He said, I had to assume temporal power at the age of 16. This last time he was just in New York, like last week or something, the way he phrased it was, I lost my freedom at 16. But years ago, he went on to say, I had to flee into exile. In my early 20s, I've had to daily try to keep an exiled culture intact. I've had to daily hear about, you know, some of the terrible suffering happening inside of Tibet. He said, it hasn't been such an easy life. And then he went on to say, but I'm pretty happy. And of course, that's what one senses in him. You know, he's pretty happy. And clearly, it's not an ordinary kind of happiness based on getting what we want, having only nice events and things and people come our way. It's an unusual sense of happiness, which is much more based on the sense of inner abundance. So he went on to say, I'm pretty happy, even though it hasn't been such an easy life, because of the sense of compassion. Compassion makes me feel at one with everyone. So you think about the non-defensiveness, the lack of the kind of crazy self-preoccupation we have. We're always fretting. And we meet somebody, and here, you know, the Dalai Lama often quotes, I've never met anyone I consider a stranger. I've never met anyone I consider a stranger. And think about how lovely that would be, even for like an hour. Instead of meeting somebody and going through the litany that we usually go through, which is more like, what do they think of me? Do they like me? How much do they like me? And we barely even notice them. It's very tiring. So I'm pretty happy, even though it hasn't been such an easy life, because of the force of compassion. Compassion makes me feel at one with everyone. That unusual source of happiness is the way one can keep going in some very frustrating, difficult, painful situations. And it's got a good dose of equanimity in it. Balance, perspective, a very, very, very different sense of time. An acknowledgement of the unknown. That what we see in front of us isn't necessarily the end of the story. Just the next unfolding. That life is as it is. That we do what we can do. And then there needs to be a kind of letting go. All of that. So, compassion allows us to go forward, to be present. It's not the same as feeling bad, feeling overcome. Because once we fall into that, we just want to go to bed. And there's nothing more logical than that at that time. It's a process. We go back and forth, inevitably. One important thing, as always, is to understand the difference. Even a theoretical understanding is very helpful. To begin to explore, it's like the contours, the nature of compassion, what it is, what it isn't, what we're used to, how we can move out of some of those traps. So a lot of that has to do with wisdom and the evolution of the power of equanimity. And almost like my main story about compassion also has to do with the Dalai Lama, which I tell over and over again, because interestingly enough, it happened in 1979, and it still remains for me the defining moment of my understanding of compassion, in a way, and that is we founded the Insight Meditation Society in 1976, and then in 1979, we heard the Dalai Lama was coming to the area. He was coming to Amherst College, which is about 40 minutes away, 45 minutes away from Barrie, the town where our center is. And being young and brash, we invited him. We sent a letter to the private office and said, hey, we're a Buddhist center. Maybe he'd like to come. And to our amazement, at one point, we got a letter back saying, yeah, he's coming. So, even though, you know, security in those days is nothing like what it is now. It was very stringent and intense for us. The center is about 2 miles outside of the center of town on this little street called Pleasant Street. And we had a blockade Pleasant Street, and we had state troopers patrolling the roof with guns, and it was really very intense. And just before he came, I had been in a car accident, and I was using crutches, which would not have been a problem, except that I was not very skillful with my use of crutches. So the day dawned that he was to arrive, and there's this whole big zooey scene, and the state troopers and the whole thing, and I was standing in the back of about 100 people in front of the center waiting for his car. And my inner dialogue was something like this: I'm so unfortunate, I'm stuck way in the back. Here I am, I'm in the back. I started the place, for God's sake. Why aren't I in the front? No, I can't go in the front because I'll fall on my face, you know. That would be even worse. How embarrassing would that be? You know, I'll just trip over the crutches, and as usual, and I'll fall on my face. It'd be so terrible. Oh, but I'm in the back. It's like, so that was sort of my inner dialogue. And then his car came, and he did something I've seen him do many times since, but it was like the first time I'd ever seen him, which is he seems to have a kind of radar for who in a crowd is suffering the most, and that was me. It's like he got out of the car, he cut through 100 people, he came up to me, he took my hand, he looked me in the eye, and he said, "What happened?" And it was so beautiful because it's still, it's quite interesting, I'm just reflecting now how many years it's been and how it still remains the moment that kind of defined compassion for me in a new way, because I saw that he could not make the injury not have happened. He couldn't make me any more skillful with my use of the crutches, but that terrible corrosive feeling of, I'm so in the back, nobody sees me. Nobody knows how much this hurts. Here I am, way in the back. It's like it was gone. He just wiped that out, that sense of isolation. And I thought, okay, that's compassion. Because sometimes we cannot make the suffering go away. It's not in our hands, or it's not in our hands in our timetable. There's so much unknown about the unfolding of life. And yet, when we have like resilience and openness and that strength of compassion, when we're not just overcome by that other state, we actually can be there more. You know, and this isn't just idealism, and it's not to say we do not fall into overwhelm. Of course we do. But we can also understand the tools we can cultivate. And above all, the understanding we can have about what will replenish us and what will renew us and how important that sense of inner abundance is in being able to once again go forward and be present. How important it is that we don't get confused by the need to be in control and make it all go away. So many things. All of which I think we come to understand in a much greater degree through our mindfulness and through our practice.